tuned in to Word of Mom Radio here on the Word of Mom Media Network.
Welcome to the Village Vision Podcast, where community, collaboration, and care converge. I'm Dr. Crystal Morrison, and I'm honored to be your host on this incredible journey. As a firm believer in the power of a united village, I'm thrilled to bring you inspiring stories, research, and projects that break down barriers in care. Through heartfelt conversations with experts, advocates, and those with lived experiences, we'll showcase the transformative impact of collective support. So join me on the Village Vision Podcast as we explore the remarkable collaborations that lead to better outcomes, foster a sense of community, and inspire action to improve care for ourselves and everyone around us. On today's episode, I'm here with Dr. Simone Kolish. Dr. Kolish grew up in Russia as an Armenian refugee from Azerbaijan and later moved to the United States. Dr. Kolish has a degree in biology and a master's in public health from NYU and later received a PhD in sociology. After spending some time in academia, Dr. Kolish now leads Defiant Life Coaching. Welcome, Dr. Kolish.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Wonderful. One of the first things I noticed about Defiant Life Coaching, I have to admit, is the phoenix on your logo. I have multiple phoenix tattoos, so I just love it. Great logo, but the phoenix means an awful lot to me, and I'm sure that it means a lot to you as well, right?
Yes.
Great. Well, I want to talk about your current work with Defiant Life Coaching, but like you, I've had a lot of very different life experiences, and I know in talking to you that a lot of your life experiences really shape why you're doing life coaching today. But I really would love to talk a little bit more about the why behind your work and what really inspired you to start Defiant Life Coaching and the other work that you're doing today.
When I was in the United States and a young adult, I, like so many immigrants, was going to be a physician. And it was an interest of mine, medicine and healthcare, but I realized there's a lot of inequality embedded into those systems. And I loved research and science and was a biologist from the age of 15 doing pancreatic cancer research. And when I ran into those inequalities, it really appalled me. I never knew I was autistic. I do now, but yeah. Had a very clear sense of justice. I couldn't really reconcile how I wanted to be this amazing doctor with like what I was learning. And so I took some time, got a master's in public health. And I think that made it all much worse in a sense. I learned about the social determinants of health and illness and how that's what contributes to negative outcomes or to mortality. And so I worked for the American Cancer Society and saw firsthand the difference between people who have money and people who don't, or racial differences, cultural differences in survivorship from cancer, and was just really burnt out. And I decided that a good response to such burnout was to get a PhD. And
I'm laughing because I know, just like, oh, I'm really burned out, so I'm going to go to grad school.
That's right. And, you know, I don't know why we're that delusional, all of us collectively, but that's, you know, and I think that in many ways, autistic and neurodivergent people try to escape into graduate school, but then get really traumatized because of that process and the way it's designed. So I went into a sociology PhD program to learn about people and society. And it was really eye-opening. I didn't feel that sociology was critical enough. So I got an additional certificate in women's gender and sexuality studies. I focused on LGBTQ studies and transgender and non-binary studies. So I did a lot of additional education and certification to kind of give me a broader perspective. And I was in New York at the time, and my dissertation and now first book called Everyday Violence, The Public Harassment of Women and LGBTQ People, came out of the 10 years of research I did in New York on how women and LGBTQ people are harassed in public spaces. And so that was kind of the culmination of my dissertation and PhD. And afterwards, as you noted, I was a full-time sociologist here in Maryland, and that didn't really work out. And once I regrouped, I launched Defiant Life Coaching because I wanted to combine all of my background and lived experience into something really focused, into working one-on-one with people. And it healed a lot of wounds, I think, because I thought life was supposed to look one way and was it all a waste? But it turns out it was not. And it got me exactly where I needed to be to help the people who need my help especially.
Yeah. And I do think that that is a myth that we continue to reinforce in our society, that you're going to go to college, you might go to grad school, and you're going to do what you trained to do for the rest of your life in this very linear path of your career. And it's not remotely like that, nor should we expect it to be, because we're continuously learning. And you know, that's a thread throughout your story, that you are continuously learning and seeking knowledge. And sometimes those of us that are knowledge seekers struggle even more with justifying the things that are happening around us once we gain more and more knowledge, because we can't just look away. And being neurodivergent also makes us sometimes see things in black and white, one way or the other, and makes the concept of justice and the lack of justice even more of a struggle. But that's a whole other podcast. I really want to talk about the work that you're doing today. And finding a life coach can be really hard. And there's a lot of life coaches out there today. But the work that you're doing, I feel, is really, really unique. And so talk to us a little bit about what kind of support are people looking for when they come to you in Defiant Life Coaching? What does that look like?
I want to talk about my own breakdown.
Sure, let's do it.
A few years back, when all the rugs were pulled from under me and mm-hmm. I was struggling, and of course I was always in therapy and that was nice, but I got on TikTok during COVID, like so many of us, and learned a lot and came across mm-hmm. life coaches, and I didn't have a good sense for what that is and gave it a shot, and she was a great fit at that time. But then when I diagnosed myself with autism a year after, I looked for an autistic life coach, and one showed up across my TikTok. She doesn't even have mm-hmm. a TikTok anymore. And it changed my life to speak to an autistic provider, because I never had such an experience. And, she helped me so much at that very crucial point of retroactively looking at your life and saying, my God, it all makes sense. She really led me through that and inspired me to become a life coach, because there are not enough of us who are autistic or neurodivergent helping other autistic or neurodivergent people. And I said, well, I can do that. And I can also do patient advocacy because of my public health background.
Right.
I can do household management. I can do work around people's gender and sexuality journeys mm-hmm. and like help them come into their queer and trans identity. You know, it mm-hmm. just all made sense. And I'm a mother of four, and I'm a non-binary mother of four. So my second book that I'm writing right now fits directly into my life coaching. It's on reproductive journeys of transgender and non-binary people. So I have mm-hmm. clients who are trying to find their place in the world, understand their queer and trans identity, and maybe add to their family as well. So they need support accepting themselves, accepting society for how difficult it is, and then trying to bring children into this world in an unusual mm-hmm. way through, you know, IUI or IVF or reciprocal IVF. And that also requires us to understand that not everyone is able to access that or afford that, and not everyone feels welcome at fertility clinics. And that goes back to, you know, homophobia and transphobia. So, you know, meeting people who are neurodivergent or suspect they're neurodivergent at a point in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, where they tried it the way we tried it, you know, the marriage, the college, the career, and then everything fell apart or feels like it's falling apart, and they're not satisfied, or they're lost, or they have, I think, been consistently gaslit by friends, family, and doctors and therapists. And so they're coming to me having a lot of experience being gaslit. And so finally they get to me and they're, you know, kind of confessing, I think I might be autistic. I think I might be a lesbian. I think I hate my marriage or whatever. And I'm here to say, great. I believe you. And let's get you out of this. Because people, when we're in it, it's hard to see a way out. But for me, having been through it and having healed and having great boundaries now, I can see a very clear path for people right away. And that's really reassuring because they don't have to go it alone. I say, look, you know, you're in it, but I'm a little bit on the outside and can take the burden off of you. The following things so that we can figure out your health journey. We can figure out the steps. A lot of neurodivergent people who are in burnout need the order of operations. And that's what they need to dump everything onto me and then say, where do I pull first in this whole cluster? And then I suggest what we should start with and they agree or disagree. And it's really very client led in terms of what they feel safe and comfortable to do. But because everything in our lives is connected, if we start talking chronic illness, we'll eventually end up talking, you know, trauma, then we'll end up talking intimacy, then we'll end up talking motherhood. And it's extensive work. And I think to your point about how there are a lot of life coaches, but not enough of life coaches like myself, those life coaches are a good fit for neurotypical people. And they have these like goal setting approaches and not very neuroaffirming. It's not really cognizant of how we function in the world. And so it doesn't work. So I've been talking to a lot of them in different spaces across social media to try to say, you know, when your clients aren't achieving the goals you set for them, they're not low quality clients, as they call them, or resistant. They're neurodivergent. Yep. They may not know. You have to shift your paradigm a little bit. But yeah, I used to think, you know, life coaches are kind of bubbly cheerleaders, and I am that way, but I'm also here for the mess. You know, for the like the truth of it, I'm adult now, or I feel a little bit more mature to just kind of say, all right, you know, drop it on me, like what you think big, scary thing is. And it never is as scary as people feel it to be, because we all go through crises that we think are personal and very private and embarrassing, but people have been through this before. And before I conclude this comment, I just want to say, I feel like life coaching, I mean, it has that phraseology, but I feel like it's as old as time to have guides
100%.
And to have people who have been through something tell others how to make it through that something.
Right, right. I agree. And I absolutely love that you brought up about some of the things that someone who is autistic or neurodivergent are looking for. It's very true that a lot of times, not always, that order of operations, some guidance, some thinking through things, but that order of operations is so important. And just setting a goal with a life coach or in therapy, that goal coupled without kind of you do this, this, and this, or if this doesn't work, here's an alternative. Without that, the goal is kind of like what I call a naked goal, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, and I'm just speaking from personal experience, but sometimes even therapy sessions and traditional therapy sessions and therapist style for those who are neurodivergent can be such a challenge, because it's like, okay, I just spent an hour talking, but now what the hell do I do, right? Because I need a plan. I need an order, right? And so I just want to come back and highlight that as like a tremendous value of what you're doing and your approach, because I think without that, that's a reason that coaching and therapy often doesn't work for people who are neurodivergent. And it's not that they aren't capable of setting goals and following through. It's that their lens on the world is just a little different, and there might be more explicit steps involved, right?
Yes, I really want to say that what I hear all the time is just how cerebral and self-aware we are, and how we are met with therapists who say that we are very reflective and we know ourselves really well. So it's almost like therapy has done its job, or like, you know, has concluded its work. But what my clients want are concrete steps, or the understanding that they can't achieve those steps because they have demand avoidance or burnout or something. And so that we shift gears and we body double together. I get them to do the things that they are embarrassed they haven't done. Like, I coach really powerful people, but also in powerful positions, and they are surgeons and physicians, whatever. And they do the laundry, and it's been like 3 weeks, and they can't tell anyone that. And so I managed to support them through getting the laundry done and all these things that they think they should be doing, but actually they can't because they're at capacity, they're at their limit. And so it's the concrete steps, but the understanding also that they're not a failure if they don't achieve those steps, and we'll just roll them onto the next set of things we try to accomplish. And I actually think we learn something from people's inability to achieve specific goals, and that's something is maybe like a clearer understanding that they're depleted, that they're at their limit,
and absolutely
they're not capable. It's just they need rest first, they need to recalibrate first, they need to get out of autistic inertia or ADHD inertia or burnout. And then these people are of course extremely competent, you know, and they can hyper focus on intense subjects, and of course they can do it. I know they can do it, but they can't, and that's okay.
and just to restate that, to re-summarize that, it does not mean that not achieving a goal or goals means someone is incapable or incompetent.
That's right.
Like, that is something that is so very important for neurotypical people to understand, is not achieving something does not equal incompetent or unable.
Mm-hmm.
Just might need to be a little bit of a different process to get there, or rethinking the goal, and it's just not right at all anyway.
Right. And it's because we need an accommodation, and we need support, and we don't have to achieve everything independently. I think that's one of the things that we have to debunk, that all tasks should be accomplished independently, and if they aren't, then that means something, and it doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't. One of my children is autistic, and I very much protect my child's identity. One of the challenges I think they're having is that their life has not taken that very traditional linear path post high school, and despite my diligent effort to constantly say that that doesn't have to happen, that's sort of the expectation of the rest of the world. And even as a parent who's always been supportive of a non-traditional approach and trying things out, my child is still at a point right now where they're really doubting themselves in a lot of ways, in a different way than when they were in college and a little bit younger. So I think that these ages and stages and needs and expectations that we put on ourselves evolve tremendously, but also evolve tremendously for those of us who are neurodivergent, and not only dealing with our own stuff, but what we think is expected by everybody else. It's so much mess, right? The mess that you get involved in.
We tried so hard to read society and their rules, and we tried so hard to perform them, and then end up kind of shocked that there is no reciprocity, or maybe that investment wasn't worth it, or because you pushed through many of your boundaries or being well or whatever, that now, like I keep saying, in your 40s, all of a sudden, you have a lot of autoimmune issues. You have a lot of stress you've accumulated. You've been masking yourself at work for decades, and that's not sustainable. So people come to me and I say, honestly, every single aspect of your life has to change. And that's so overwhelming. But you're going to take it baby step by baby step, because you deserve not only physical rest, but spiritual rest and the other six types of rest that exist. And they don't even understand that, because, you know, for burnt out moms, there's not even the physical rest. And so it might be that for the first few sessions, we really work on just, let's get you drinking water, actual electrolytes, sleeping, and treat that as like a really serious task, as big as anything else you're doing at your job. And then once that's established, and it takes about, I don't know, 3 months for the brain to habituate to a new approach. And so you have to understand behavioral change. And that's something I learned in public health, because public health wants people to do something, right? To mask in a pandemic. Well, actually not anymore, but, you know, to maybe get vaccinated or to stop smoking. And I learned that people's behavioral change is difficult to accomplish, actually, because we don't understand how long it takes for the brain to get rewired a little bit. And are very stubborn. Many of us are traumatized. We have knee-jerk reactions. Our body reacts. To, and it's actually sabotaging your future self. And so you have to understand neurodivergence and the intensity with which our own brains fight us on some of the goals we have, you know, even if no one's around. That inertia I was talking about, that buffering that I call buffering, it's even when you yourself want to achieve something, like go get up and shower, and then 2 hours later, you're still in bed. And then those ableist ideas about what that means that you're not able to get out of bed start crawling through your brain.
Yeah.
And then you feel like a failure and all that stuff that people come to me with, and they say, you know, I'm a failure, I'm a monster, I'm a villain. Like, people really do say very mean things about themselves. And I have to be like, absolutely not. We're not doing that. We're going to reword and rephrase and actually kind of neutralize this a little bit, you know, and you're not a monster. You're a kid and you haven't slept in like 15 years.
Yeah. Like the thought of not really sleeping and getting rest for that long. I mean, it's absurd, but it's real. It's real.
But it's happening all the time. There are so many mothers who say, I haven't had 10 minutes to myself in like 2 decades. And that means they're in autistic burnout, meltdown, shutdown, just perpetually. Like, there's no recovery, you know? And so that means it's going to take a little bit. And your podcast is about this united village. And I think a lot of therapy and life coaching is individual based, but mine is about the collective, and also thinking, you know, how to spread the burden that we face onto our partners, and even have those conversations with our children and our family, and also with our coworkers and friends about how much support we require,
right?
And how that's important, and also how trauma is collectively experienced as well, not just individually. And so, as a sociologist, I understand it needs collective approaches to healing.
Agreed. Agreed. And so much of how healing from trauma really needs to happen comes from community. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. Or if we do realize it, I am the first one to admit that even though I do realize it fundamentally, I really find it difficult to ask for help.
Yeah.
Whether it's that combination of mom guilt or any number of things, asking for help in our society has always been cast as weakness, or your inability to cope, or your inability to, you know, manage situations. And so, you know, I know that from a very logical standpoint, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm so very resistant to asking for help sometimes. So it's something I'm still working on. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Because, you know, we'll be working on things until we transition to our next
That's very, we're always a work in progress, aren't we?
Yes.
Well, I want to wrap up today, but I definitely want to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know how they can reach out to you, how they can find you, and maybe some examples of how you can work with them.
Earlier, you mentioned a message that I want to leave people with. And I always think, regardless of whether we work together, you got to find someone who sees you, who validates you, who treats you like an equal, like a partner in your journey, right? And I want people to really understand that they are allowed to be unapologetically themselves. So in terms of their neurodivergence and disability, gender, sexuality, in terms of their desires and wanting their needs to be met, especially for moms. I want moms to know that selflessness is not a virtue. They have a full self, and that self gets to be selfish and also gets to ask for help and also gets to say, this is difficult for me. I'm having a meltdown, and figure out ways to help yourself. And people can work with me by going to defiantlifecoaching.com. My consults are 30 to 45 minutes. They are free. They are 7 days a week. They are during the day and during the night, because mothers can only relax after everyone goes to bed. And so often I work with people late into the night, into 3 a.m. Eastern time. And I'm on all social media platforms as Defiant Life Coaching. So you could find me on TikTok, which I love, and Instagram and Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, just to see what kind of content I produce. And I am unapologetically myself too. So it's not gimmicky. It's not salesy, spammy.
Yeah.
Me, none of it. It's just me. And I think the people who are a good fit for me and for whom I'm a good fit will find me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, all of Dr. Kolish's contact information and links will be in our show notes, so you can find them there. Dr. Kolish, thank you so much for joining us today on the Village Vision podcast. I'm so grateful that you shared your story. Your experience and perspective is so important. And thank you so much for sharing it with our listeners.
Thank you to you and to the listeners as well. I hope to be back to talk some justice.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us on the Village Vision podcast. I hope you found inspiration and valuable insights from our conversation today. If you've enjoyed today's episode on Word of Mom Radio, please subscribe, rate, leave a review, and share. Thank you for being a part of the Village Vision podcast. Take care, and let's keep shining a light on the power of community, collaboration, and care.
She is sure.
She is sure.
She is strong.
She is strong.
She is true.
She is true.
She is brave.
She is brave.
She is bold.
She is bold.
She is you.
She is you. She is you. She is you.
She is sure.
She is sure.
She is strong.
She is
sure.
She is sure.
She is